Yeah, he said it's safe to come out.
Now, we're not willing to take that risk right now.
I can't hear you.
We're not taking that risk right now.
Okay, well, come to the door and look at my bag, bro.
No. Yeah, bro.
He said bro.
Red flags.
Those were the chilling sounds from inside an Oxford, Michigan classroom last Tuesday. A teacher huddled together with students as a gunman walked the school, shooting indiscriminately at anyone in his path. We'd later learn that the alleged gunman is 15 years old and a student at the school, where two teachers had raised concerns over his behavior the day before. But despite these teacher concerns, he was allowed to return to school, which he did, with a gun. He killed 4 students, injured 7 others, and now is charged with murder and terrorism. On Friday, prosecutors brought other charges.
Based on the information and evidence I have received, today I am announcing charges against the shooter's parents, Jennifer and James Crumbly. James Crumbly is charged with 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter. Jennifer Crumbly is also charged with 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter.
Prosecutor Karen McDonald.
While the shooter was the one who entered the high school and pulled the trigger, there are other individuals who contributed to this, to the events on November 30th, and it's my intention to hold them accountable as well.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and today on The Takeaway, we start with the question of who is accountable for gun violence. With me now is Jonathan Metzl, director of the Department of Medicine, Health, and Society, and a professor of sociology and psychiatry at Vanderbilt University. Jonathan, always good to have you with us.
Likewise.
So prosecutors filing these involuntary manslaughter charges against the parents, is that typical?
It is highly untypical. In fact, it's incredibly rare. There's a long line of different kinds of shootings where kids are either purchased handguns or rifles by their parents or pick up guns in the home. And for over a decade now, there have been attempts to either prosecute or hold parents responsible. And it's very rare, even in cases as egregious as this one. So I'm glad this is happening. These are egregious and really truly unconscionable efforts by the parents to put the guns in the hands of the perpetrator. But I think that we rarely see this kind of legal action.
You know, Jonathan, I'm sure that some of our listeners have heard why these steps were taken, but others may not have if they were having a busy weekend doing something else. Walk us through a little bit when you say this was egregious. What happened in this case to make this rare situation of a prosecutor feeling like the parents were not just neglectful, but maybe actually had some level of culpability here?
Well, we've seen in the news that there were warning signs at the school. The shooter had been writing notes and searching for guns and ammunition, but you can pretty much guarantee that those warning signs were seen in tenfold at home and for a much longer period of time. And in that context, the family went out and purchased a weapon for the shooter, a 15-year-old kid. They also took him for target practice. They, bought him ammunition. They kept encouraging him. Even at the time where he was caught searching for ammunition, the mother texted, just don't get caught next time, in a certain kind of way. And so we often hear, it's the guy who drives the car is as guilty as the guy who robs the bank. And in this case, you can amplify that in a certain kind of way. They really did literally put the gun in his hands. And the other important part of the information here is that there was a concern meeting at the school, and the parents knew that they had purchased this weapon. And so to not alert school officials and refuse to take their son home and let him go back into class, I think was really the final kicker here.
When we narrow down to putting the guns in the hands, but I wonder, when you make that metaphor about the guy who drives the car is as guilty as the person who themselves is committing the crime, how much are all of us driving the car? In other words, how much is there a broader sort of social, cultural culpability here based on our gun culture and the ways that we have failed for decades to restrict access even to young people having guns?
Well, that's exactly the point here. I mean, I certainly hope that out of this horrible tragedy comes some kind of reasoned conversation about broader cultural culpability. I mean, think about what we've done over the past decade and beyond. We've lowered the age of who can carry a gun, who can carry a concealed and open weapon. We've also broadened the kind of realm of permissible shootings. We saw with the Rittenhouse case, 17-year-old kid, and when people feel threatened, they're justified firing weapons. And so in a way, we really have paved the road for this kind of use. Now, this is clearly a crime, but I think when you get into the question of, okay, it's okay for younger people to carry a weapon, and it's also permissible when you feel threatened to for defensive use of a gun, that, you know, there are so many cases that are nowhere near this egregious. And I think that's part of the issue. So that's one part of the question. And then the other part is there's just a long history, as I mentioned before, of the lack of culpability. I mean, we've had cases in Tennessee where parents of kids under 10 left guns around that weren't put in a safe or no trigger locks. And just the attempts to try to make parents responsible for the actions of their kids is also, unfortunately, a long and failed history. And we haven't done anything about that either.
We've seen this, interestingly enough, in very different kinds of circumstances around, for example, truancy, right? And fining parents or holding parents responsible for truancy. And largely that had gone kind of out of vogue as a public policy, especially when we saw the ways in which it was really leveled against families of color and urban families and families living in poverty more so than for wealthy families. But I'm wondering if this will sort of bring back that narrative a bit.
Well, I certainly think there's just a case, even stepping, going a bit higher, just who is seen as a patriot or a guardian and who's seen as a threat, who gets to carry a gun. So certainly there's a larger racial politics just about gun ownership that I think is certainly important here. And then it's just interesting about, as you say, which parents are held accountable. That's why I think the charges are so important here in a particular way, because there really is a bigger question, and one we've debated for a long time, both about kind of racial politics in the United States and also particularly about gun ownership and the responsibility of parents. And so I think there are so many layers here, and I think there's even at this point, at this end point of so many guns and so few laws, I do think it's so important that these charges are being brought now so that we can really think about the question of who's a guardian, who's a terrorist in a particular way, and maybe try to change course a little bit.
Now, as we think about, again, sort of broadening back the question of who might be responsible or who is culpable, you talked a bit about the school. Is there any possibility here that the school will also potentially be held accountable and that could have some consequences? Again, you know, I always worry in cases this egregious if they end up setting a precedent that goes to a kind of zero tolerance policy that ends up having unintended consequences.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think the lesson for me of this case is just how much this is a system problem, right? You could have the most responsible school in the world, and if the parents are buying their kid a weapon and encouraging ammunition, all these kind of things. So you really can't have a system that's going to be foolproof against something as unpredictable as this if the school and the parents and the community are not all working together. And so I think the takeaway for me of this case is really that with this one weak link in that system, it's not foolproof. Now, that being said, I do also worry. I mean, it seems to me like the school, I mean, certainly they are grieving about not taking the gun out of that backpack, not checking that backpack, letting that kid go back into the school. And so I don't want to say that it was like a perfect plan by any way, but I would also say that the flip side, as you say, is that so many kids voice threats. So many kids play violent video games. Kids also reflecting their parents search online for guns and ammo. That's just the world we live in today. And so the question is, where do you draw the line? And unfortunately, experts like psychiatrists, like myself, like school counselors, they're not great at predicting which of the many kids that play video games, for example, are going to go on to commit real life violence. And so I think the risk, as you say, is that there's a kind of overcorrection in a particular way that really penalizes or surveils too many kids. But again, I think that in a way, really, this is a system problem, and it has to be looked at as such.
So when we talk about systems, obviously one important part of that system are the guns themselves. You know, when young people were getting into, you know, Tylenol and having, there were fatal consequences, the manufacturers of Tylenol had to, you know, change how you open. And I just use Tylenol as a brand name to talk about medications in general, right? So medications now have safety locks that make it harder for kids to get into. I'm wondering if there is a culpability of the gun manufacturers themselves.
There is not. I mean, that's part of the issue, is that we've seen safer cars. When cars were killing people, we got more anti-lock brakes and better seatbelt laws. When cigarettes were killing people, we got anti-smoking legislation. But gun manufacturers have been notoriously free from culpability for their products. And the other issue, as we were talking about before, is that also the use of weapons. And we had a case in Tennessee. It was called McKaylee's Law. It was about 10 years ago. And there were parents who were just leaving their firearms around the home. And I think it was an 8-year-old kid picked up the gun, took outside and killed another kid who was under 10 years old. And it was a horrible, it was very reminiscent of the conversation we're having now. And everybody rallied on all sides and said, look, let's at least pass some laws that hold parents responsible for safe storage so that their kids don't pick up guns and kill other kids. And I'll never forget it. We had about, you know, everybody on all sides of this debate was basically saying now is the time for change until the day before the vote was going to get taken in the Tennessee legislature. And the NRA flew in an army of lobbyists, and the next morning everybody changed their vote. And so holding gun manufacturers or parents or really anybody culpable for these kind of events is a debate we've had before. And unfortunately, we've come up empty time and again.
Jonathan, I wanted to ask you, in part because we tend to focus on mass shootings. We barely even focus on them anymore. But to the extent that the media thinks about shootings and the deaths of young people, it's in that context. And I'm just wondering if there's a way that we lose the actual larger count, the day-to-day gun violence deaths that take so many lives.
Every time something horrific like a high-profile mass shooting or school shooting happens, we all focus on how can we stop this one specific event, but we never look at the bigger picture, which is the broader spectrum of gun violence and gun trauma in America. Most gun death is gun suicide. 2/3 of gun death is gun suicide. Partner violence is really out of control and has been getting much worse over the course of the pandemic. The frustrating part for me is that actually those kinds of gun death are much more responsive to public health interventions. And so certainly I think that we can't lose sight of the fact that there's just an everyday toll of gun death in this country. And it's been unfortunately getting worse over the course of the pandemic, not only as we've seen more shootings, but as we've sold unprecedented numbers of guns across this country.
Jonathan Metzl is director of the Department of Medicine, Health and Society, and a professor of sociology and psychiatry. Jonathan, as always, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks so much.
We turn now to California, where every fall in recent years, the local news reports have sounded like this.
Overnight, bone-tired firefighters locked in another desperate struggle to gain ground against hundreds of hungry wildfires churning through California.
According to estimates from CAL FIRE, more than 4 million acres in the state burned in 2020, and another 3 million have been lost to blazes in 2021. The fires have destroyed thousands of homes and claimed dozens of lives. And the realities of global climate change suggest that this destruction is likely to be a new normal for the state. And when your state is literally on fire, there is no hero more worthy of respect and adoration than a firefighter. Which is why many of the other local news reports in recent years have sounded like this one from ABC 10 in Sacramento.
Thank them for everything that they're doing.
The more than 4,000 firefighters working to protect their communities from the Caldor fire are top of mind.
I want to thank them for doing the best job that they can.
But many of the heroic firefighters battling blazes in the Golden State are probably not who you might think. Nearly 30% of California firefighters are incarcerated, and a recent report from Teen Vogue highlights the juvenile justice facility contributing young men to the front lines of California's fire battles. Pine Grove. It's the last fire camp for incarcerated youth in the state. The juvenile justice facility is where incarcerated boys and young men between the ages of 17 and 24 are trained to fight fires. 95% of these young men are Black, Latinx, or Filipino. For risking their lives fighting fires, they earn between $2.20 and $4 an hour. Now, California firefighters who are not incarcerated typically earn more than $40 an hour. Sarah Tardif is a freelance reporter for Teen Vogue, and she looked into the Pine Grove facility for a recent piece.
Pine Grove Youth Conservation Camp is a low-security juvenile detention facility here in California where teenage boys and young men ages 17 through 24 are incarcerated. And once they turn 18, they're formally trained to contain and prevent wildfires. They earn between $2.20 and $4 an hour, plus an additional $1 an hour when they're actively fighting fires. And the work that they do is incredibly dangerous, and they receive the same level of training as seasonal firefighters here in California. And even despite the low wage, being on a fire campaign crew is still the best paid job in the California prison system.
Okay, let's back up for a second. So these are young people. So they were incarcerated based on crimes committed when they were juveniles. Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
But some of them go into adulthood. So in other words, they pass 18 while still in this youth conservation camp?
Yes, yes. So the youngest age that you can be when you arrive is 17. And so then a few weeks before your 18th birthday, you then begin training to work on a fire hand crew. And so then going forward, you work, you know, right alongside Cal Fire, wildfire employees.
And how do the young people end up in this, you know, presumably in the whole state of California, there's lots of different places where young people might end up being detained after being convicted of a crime. How do young people end up in Pine Grove?
Sure. So everyone who is incarcerated at Pine Grove volunteered to be transferred there. To qualify, you have to have a minimum custody status, meaning you haven't committed any violent crimes like murder, kidnapping, sexual assault, or you have to have proof of ongoing good behavior. And so they are transferred to Pine Grove. It's usually a relatively small facility, around 80 to 100 people at any given time. And it's, like I mentioned before, it's low security. So there are no guard towers, there's no fences. And they're trusted to protect the community and be out in the community doing hard, dangerous labor and doing things like wielding axes and learning how to use chainsaws to do that difficult forestry work.
Now, is this a new practice for those who are incarcerated to be fighting fires?
No, this is actually part of a longstanding West Coast tradition. During World War II, a lot of forestry jobs were left unfilled when people went to serve overseas. And so the government sort of turned to this mass exploitation of inmates, essentially, formalizing the practice by creating what we now know as fire camps. And so Pine Grove was opened in 1945, and it was the first youth fire camp in the state. And at its peak, there were six fire camps just for, you know, teenage boys and young men in California, all of which have since closed except for Pine Grove. And it's the oldest continuously operating fire camp in the country.
Surely, given the long tradition of thinking of juvenile incarceration as rehabilitative, right? Even more so than we've thought about this for adult incarceration. We've thought if young people are incarcerated by the state, then they should be in a system that will rehabilitate. So surely, given the training that they have, once they're released, they become firefighters?
The pathway to employment after being released from a fire camp like Pine Grove is not an easy one. There really aren't any formal pathways that exist. It was about a year ago now that Governor Gavin Newsom signed Assembly Bill 2147, which allows previously incarcerated firefighters who have not been convicted of violent crimes to appeal to have their record expunged. And that, you know, in theory is helpful because it makes them eligible for EMT training, which is a crucial requirement for many, not all firefighting jobs, but a good portion of them. But even accessing that training, it still isn't a guarantee or even a clear path to employment. And so we have nonprofit organizations and programs like the Forestry and Fire Recruitment Program that run things like expungement clinics for this exact reason, to help people have, you know, a better shot at finding full-time work as firefighters, but it's only marginally helpful. We are currently experiencing a quote-unquote firefighter shortage, but a lot of the people who I have spoken to who were held at Pine Grove in the last decade or so have had an incredibly difficult time even finding part-time work as firefighters.
So help me to understand a bit. Is this something we should be celebrating? Because here are young people who are incarcerated but are earning more than other incarcerated young people? Or is this something we should be appalled about because we are putting very young people in harm's way and paying them obviously a bizarrely sub-minimum wage at $2 an hour?
If the specialized training at Pine Grove doesn't ultimately lead to work as a firefighter upon release, then who is the youth fire camp ultimately serving? What about it is rehabilitative? You know, a lot of fire departments in California require their hirees to be at least 21 years of age and to have a high school diploma or a GED. And those requirements, you know, those standards are not the same for incarcerated teenage boys and young men at Pine Grove.
I'm wondering about what the alternatives are here. So is this about ensuring that there is a pathway for these young people? Or is this about saying, hey, we just simply shouldn't be using prison labor to do dangerous work on behalf of the state?
I think there's definitely a bit of tension between the community and then local activists. So the Division of Juvenile Justice will be closing in June 2023. And so many of its facilities have already been shut down or will be shut down. And those that remain open will become the responsibility of local jurisdictions. And Pine Grove is one of those facilities that will remain open through a state-local partnership. And there was a bit of time there where it was uncertain whether or not the camp would close. And so the community really rallied around the camp and was really enthusiastic about, you know, the brave work that these young people are doing to protect the community. But it's an unavoidable part of the conversation that these are effectively young people. 95% of them are Black, Latin, and Filipino, and they are working for dollars an hour compared to free firefighters who are making $41 an hour and doing work in communities that they haven't even really had a chance to be a part of in their adulthood.
I'm wondering, when we look at a connection like this, one that is, as you pointed out here, problematic and maybe not even completely obvious what the right or just outcome is. But I'm wondering if it creates a kind of green, black or green, brown divide, this idea that it's okay to use racially marginalized populations of young people who are incarcerated to address an ecological or environmental problem.
Yeah. And as a symptom of the climate crisis, wildfire season is now almost a year-round concern. And here in California, in 2021 alone, we've seen 3 million acres burn. And incarcerated firefighters have long been a critical part of the state's plan to survive wildfire season. In 2018 and 2019, about 27% of the state's firefighters were incarcerated. And that includes young people. During the Caldor fire, I saw some local news coverage on incarcerated firefighters who were bravely fighting this fire and saw that some of them were incarcerated at Pine Grove and that, you know, they were 18 or 19 years old. That's what sort of led me to research more about the camp itself and California's history of incarcerating young people to fight fires.
Sarah Tardif, freelance reporter for Teen Vogue, thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're back now on The Takeaway. Actor Riz Ahmed has been to a galaxy far, far away.
What's your call sign, pilot?
We have to go.
It's Rogue? Rogue One.
He embodied a heavy metal drummer, losing his hearing.
You play music, right?
No.
No?
No, not anymore. Not until I get the implant.
In real life, he's even gained a following by putting out music as Riz MC.
Raise the white flag, try to squish the beef. Your same white flag is trying to kill me. We can't separate, I'm part of you, babe. My protein made your DNA. Allow our kids to raise on your hate. Don't be shocked when they retaliate. My whole team just rats in your race.
In his latest movie, Encounter, which was released in theaters last week, Ahmed plays a Marine veteran, Malik Khan, who takes his sons on the run in an attempt to protect them from what he warns is an impending alien invasion. And while the performance breaks new ground for the dynamic actor, Ahmed is not hoping that audiences will feel he disappears into the role. In fact, he's thought a lot about the metaphorical masks actors don, and he says he doesn't want to hide the real Riz anymore.
I think practically speaking, for me, just to be very specific about process, I think it means not overly relying on research, not looking too much outside of yourself for the key to unlocking a character. And that's always going to be really important to ground any portrayal in authenticity. And particularly for a character like Malik Khan, who's, you know, a US Special Forces veteran, that's not an experience that I have. So speaking to veterans, speaking to active servicemen, understanding their experience, their stories, that's absolutely essential, but only insofar as it's a gateway to finding the overlaps with your own experience and your own feelings about the world. I think before I was more interested in kind of putting my own experience away and locking it up and purely looking outside to find characters. And now I'm much more interested in where those overlaps are between you and this character on the page that you assume you have nothing in common with to begin with.
So why did you want this character? Why was Malik someone worth fighting for? I know that you convinced the director, Michael Pierce, to cast you in this role.
Yeah, I really stalked Michael, honestly. I can sometimes become a bit obsessive in this way. I remember when I was auditioning for Star Wars, the director made the mistake of giving me his email address, and I sent him about 16 auditions over 2 days. So it was a similar kind of vibe. Once I get this idea in my head, I started calling him, texting him, getting mutual friends to call him, took him out to lunch. And really what appealed to me was that, I guess I'm just really interested in films that kind of fit between genres, that occupied lots of different kind of tones at once. So on the one hand, this is a film that has the thrills and spills and the imagination of sci-fi and genre. And on the other hand, it's a very grounded relationship drama, family drama, father-son story with a lot of heart. And it's not that common for people to even attempt to bridge those two tones. So that's what was exciting from a kind of just movie point of view, from a character point of view. I just found the character really scary. I had never played someone like this. I don't immediately imagine myself into the archetype of returning American servicemen, rightly or wrongly. Probably audiences don't. And so I thought that was interesting to challenge myself and challenge audiences in that way. And finally, and I guess the most scary thing was I'd never played a dad before. Hmm. And I was quite paranoid about, which is anxious, I should say, about whether these kids would buy me as a father. And then I realized, well, that's what the character's thinking. He hasn't seen his kids for a while either. He's wondering whether he'd be convincing in that role. So when I found that overlap, as I was saying, I thought, okay, there's something here to work with.
As you were saying that
that you are challenging audiences in part by the very notion of what we imagine a returning American serviceman is, especially after more than 20 years in Afghanistan. I think this is, it actually reframes what I was going to ask you about the roles you take that are clearly about identity and those like Encounter or Sound of Metal, where it seems that race or identity are not centralized. Because now you're making me think that actually it is still at the center of what you are, or at least importantly orthogonal to what it is you're doing in this film.
You know, it's interesting because I don't think of race as being central to this film. And I actually don't think of race as being central to any of my work. What I do think is central to all work is identity. I think that's true of acting. I think that's true of all stories, really. I think they're all challenging us to reimagine our identity. That's the fundamental mechanism of storytelling. It takes the listener or the viewer and puts them into someone else's experience through this mysterious process of alchemy. And before you know it, you become someone else. And that is a challenge to our idea of self that we cling to, you know, this idea that you and the other are separate. It doesn't really stand up when you watch a good story or listen to a good story. You suddenly become someone else. So I think challenging our notions of who we are, who the other is, realizing that self and other are actually the same. I think that lies at the bedrock of all storytelling. And so identity is at the heart of all storytelling, in my view.
Yeah, that's that key insight about stories being windows and mirrors, right? That we can see ourselves, but then it's also a window into someone else's experience, maybe one that isn't what's looking back at us in the mirror.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this film really does hold up a mirror to our society. Some people have described it as sci-fi. I describe it more as now-fi. It is about an uncertain world, a divided society, a world where we have a fear of infection, a fear of the other. And I think that it's quite interesting because, you know, we turned up on set to film this movie, and I have to say that the film set or the world behind the camera felt more like sci-fi than the story we were telling. You know, we filmed this during peak COVID, and everyone on the team was in full biohazard suits. The sky was ablaze with the California forest fires, and you know, it was election season with civil unrest kind of brewing. So it felt pretty apocalyptic. So I think that this film certainly does hold up a mirror. It feels quite urgent to me, and yet it's, you know, wrapped up in just this most kind of delightfully charming family kind of story with these two incredible kids that just, yeah, I haven't seen anyone not melt, you know, when they've watched these kids on screen.
As of course the dystopic future will nonetheless have really cute kids in it, right? This is like part of the realities, right, of the smallness of our humanity, even in the enormity of our universal experiences. As you're talking about identity, there's this other piece, the pond, right, that you started in British film and television and then shifted to the U.S. industry. I'm wondering how you've experienced that shift.
It's interesting because I don't know if I've shifted or if the industry itself has shifted. And it's just more of a globalized industry, you know, particularly now with streamers. And if you think of something like Squid Game or you know, Money Heist and these kind of global shows, or Ertugrul, you know, the Turkish kind of soap opera. These are global shows. People are used to, you know, kind of crossing borders in that way to watch films and watch TV. So I think the shift from the US to UK is quite a small one. I think they're quite symbiotic as industries. In terms of like coming and shooting in America, being employed more by kind of American companies, I think that's also just an inevitability when it comes to the scale or of the American industry. In the UK, it can be a little bit smaller, so there's just not as much work.
There's another identity piece. This other identity, Riz MC, where you are not an actor in that role, but rather a maker of music. Talk to me about what it means or the parts of yourself that you're able to express as an MC that are different than your role as actor.
It's interesting because, like I said, I used to think of acting as a place where I become other people and music as a place where I really express myself. And I think over the last, many years, that boundary doesn't really exist anymore. So if you look at a project like Mogul Mowgli, it's very much about me just trying to bring all of myself to the table, my own personal experience. It's a film that's in English and in Urdu. It's a film that, I guess is some kind of Sufi horror comedy musical. It's kind of all the different genres and styles that the hybridity of my own identity is kind of expressed fully in that film as well. So I'm kind of thinking more and more that there isn't really a separation. Yeah, they're different forms, but increasingly I hope that I can just bring all of myself to all of my work. And that is definitely a shift from years gone by, where I had received or understood this message implicitly from society or from the industry that you shouldn't bring all of yourself to the table. You don't quite fit. People aren't really interested in stories like yours. Be someone else. The one thing we want you to be is someone else. And so that's kind of changed for me.
I'm wondering if that's connected to this work that your production company did in relationship with the researchers at USC, that's really showing kind of how dire the situation is for Muslim characters in film and television. Is that part of the just be someone else? And do you have sort of a message or a set of goals for Hollywood relative to telling Muslim stories?
Yeah, so this is an initiative that I launched with an amazing organization called the Pillars Fund and also University of Southern California and Dr. Stacey Smith. Her team there do a lot of research into just what the stats are, and they really confirm what many of us have kind of known anecdotally, which is that Muslim characters are either invisible or they're villainized. The report is actually called Missing or Maligned. And the stats are quite dire. I think it's like 1.6% of all speaking characters in the top 200 films in English speaking countries in the last few years are Muslim characters. 3/4 of the time when you have Muslim characters on screen, they're victims of or perpetrators of violence. And this has a real world impact. I think the effect of this is measured in enabling hate crime, enabling discriminative legislation, and enabling foreign invasions and misadventures, and war crimes. So I think that this is really a life and death issue. I feel that this isn't just my problem or Muslims' problem. This is everyone's problem. If we create a culture that demonizes people, that there will be dire consequences. And we're seeing the dire consequences of these really simplistic kind of demonizing stories all around the world right now, So I don't know, I guess my message is for Hollywood is to support this initiative. They already are. We've had great pickup. But to really kind of take stock and think about how we can open up our industry and our culture to different kinds of stories.
And I'll just ask this last. Let's say that in 10 years, you and I are able to sit down and have another conversation. What do you hope we'll be talking about in a decade?
Oh, we won't have to talk about anything other than the work. Stuff that still excites me, ideally. I feel very lucky that I'm able to do work that excites me. Film, TV, music, throwing them all together. But I guess my point is that, ideally we won't have to talk about so many of the issues surrounding the work or the obstacles to the work or the obstacles to people like me being able to make work that they're proud of, but just like... just the work, it'd be great to focus more on that rather than the issues that get in the way of that.
Riz Ahmed is an actor and his latest film, Encounter, is out now. Thanks so much for stopping by The Takeaway.
Thank you.
This Friday, Steven Spielberg's highly anticipated remake of West Side Story hits theaters. The film stars Ansel Elgort as Tony and newcomer Rachel Zegler as Maria.
What's forever? Like, I want to be with you forever.
You don't want to start maybe with I'd like to take you out to coffee?
No. Come on.
I want to take you to a shop full of nuts for a cream cheese sandwich on a raisin bread.
This ain't casual like that.
Oh.
This latest installment of West Side Story also gives audiences a glimpse of the beloved actor Rita Moreno, who earned an Oscar for her turn as Anita in the 1961 film version. Now, back in 1961, Moreno was the only Puerto Rican actor in the film. Spielberg's remake does not repeat the offensive brown face practice of casting white actors in dark makeup as Puerto Rican. But here at The Takeaway, even as we were belting out the show's familiar tunes, we were also wondering whether we need another version of this Romeo and Juliet story at all. So we spoke with Francis Negron Moutonnier, who is media scholar and professor at Columbia University.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of commentary, scholarship, testimony about that question. And there is a relatively major consensus that West Side Story had a fundamental role in codifying Puerto Rican stereotypes in media. And not only for a domestic audience, as the film West Side Story was successful at the box office here in the United States, but also worldwide. So West Side Story becomes the first major cultural product produced in Hollywood to portray Puerto Ricans as a separate, specific group, and then disseminate that portrayal at a world scale.
And particularly this separateness from American identity.
Yes, and it wasn't entirely, these stereotypes were not entirely imagined for Puerto Ricans. The makers drew from an archive of stereotypes about Latinos more generally, particularly Mexican and Mexican-Americans. But they did some adaptations, because some of the things that are different from West Side Story from prior depictions of other Latinos is that it was set in an urban setting in the midst of this context of fear of incoming migrations and immigration, intertwined with the fear of so-called juvenile delinquency. So part of the way that this image is crafted in the film and in the show is drawing from that archive of past stereotypes on Latinos and from the new depictions of incoming immigrants that are seen as connected or related or producing this so-called social problem of juvenile delinquency.
How have those troubling depictions then had long-term consequences?
One of the most stunning things, as you say, is that we are having this conversation now. So West Side Story was not only the first media product to recognize Puerto Ricans as a particular group, but it's also the only reference point that we still have 63 years after the show and 60 years after the film made the show popular worldwide. So, and that raises a lot of questions. One of them is why? Why is it that a 1957 Broadway show that has been amply criticized for its stereotypical depiction of Puerto Ricans and lack of insight in many ways of what that experience has been remains the only reference point, the only film that everybody has seen about Puerto Ricans? At the same time, West Side Story is an ambivalent narrative, and I think it cultivates a certain ambivalence in Puerto Rican and other spectators. As a narrative, one of the things that I wrote early on, the first time that I encountered West Side Story as a scholar, was how the sharks were visualized differently than the jets, and they're visualized in a way that is more attractive. They're more colorful, their movements are more nuanced and complex. So the film itself, while it stereotypes, also has a certain gaze of desire towards those bodies. It's a very complex gaze. At the same time, for Puerto Ricans and Latinos, this is a very highly valued cultural product. So it's not that you became popularized by a film that nobody thinks is worth anything. It's the most recognized film by the Academy in the Oscars as musical, and the fourth most recognized film in general. It also contains a performance by Rita Moreno, the only Puerto Rican cast, a major cast member of the original film, that won the first Oscar that a Latina or Puerto Rican woman ever earned. So that those sites in the film produce different kinds of interpolation for people. And it's one of the reasons that it also endures as a piece of conversation.
And it feels like that push-pull of that cultural product, that the love for the one Puerto Rican in a film about Puerto Ricans in New York, the love for the complexity and beauty that does show up even with this kind of maybe anthropological, like outsider's gaze, but still is there, right? The notice and recognition of it, right? And yet, also the sense of it getting so many things wrong. So I'm wondering, given that it is now all these years later and we have a remake, is it possible to do West Side Story better?
My sense is that there might be a way to go back to those materials and reimagine them radically to do something else. And one of the reasons that I think that is possible is because Latino artists and writers and filmmakers, musicians have actually taken segments or parts and fragments of West Side Story and done something else with it. So for instance, in one of the pieces I wrote, I referenced a short film by Adal Maldonado where he takes images from West Side Story and recombines them with other materials to actually do the work that West Side Story is not doing, which is capturing the pain and loss of that migratory experience. There might be a way that people can use some of those materials to do something radically different or against the grain of what these other uses have been. And of course, the history of cultural production is full of that. I mean, that's what often we are, you know, we are on the receiving end of materials, and part of what new artists, creative people, scholars have to do is work with them in some way to make other things possible.
Frances Negron Moutonnier is a media scholar and professor at Columbia University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, y'all, that's all we have for you today. I know, it's sad, but don't worry. If you want more takeaway, all you got to do is head on over to wherever you get your audio. And of course, you can always call us with your show ideas, suggestions, or even if you just have something interesting you'd like to share with us. Just call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And don't forget to send us the names and the stories of people who are doing transformative work in their communities. And we'll feature them on our transformative takeaways. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Come on back and listen some more tomorrow.